Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000-watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for sports fans who now want synchronized fireworks to be an Olympic test sport. You lived in Queens or Brooklyn, anywhere, you know that could be a reality. 940 ESPN, 940ESPNFresno.com. Your 2.5-hour tour, shortened by the San Francisco Giants and the San Diego Padres, begins right now. 6:35. Past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time, I'm the host of this program, and none other that I am aware of, Christopher Gabriel, delighted to be with you. Beautiful day here in the Central Valley of California. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us moving in the right direction. You want to weigh in during the program, you can certainly do that, 844-940-3776. That also is 940-ESPN. Follow me on Twitter. Tweet me anytime you like, at CG Program. You can email the program, CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. On the program today in a couple of minutes, a couple of things to talk about with Tony, including continuing our conversation that we were having a couple of minutes ago. Really good conversation, and we will get to that in a moment, talking about Kevin Durant. And in a rare and a very special Wednesday appearance, our Friday movie guy, Nick Shager, giving you a holiday weekend preview. Nick Shager joining us at 3:35. For those of you who have never heard him on Friday, he is the lead film critic for Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. He is as good as they get, and we are fortunate to have him on this program every Friday morning at 8:35. But this week, he's coming on in about 27 minutes. Marty Lenz, 4:05 p.m., 5:05 top 5 at 5. Don't be that guy at 5:25. And then, of course, Giants Baseball will send you the pregame of Giants and Padres. All right. So I was having a great conversation with my good friend Tony Diodato, and Tony kind enough to continue with us a little bit further. Tony, I appreciate the extra duty, my friend.
Anytime you can delay my trip to call a Dodger game, I'm forever grateful.
Well,
and you know what? I'm going to say to the Dodger fans, what kind of walk-off? Five consecutive walks with two out, nobody on. If that's a fish, you throw it back. Okay, you don't keep it in the boat. That's all I'm telling you.
And the thing that it was equally silly is, and sorry, Dodgers fans, but come on, pouring out of the dugout, running to first base, where they got. I was waiting to see them rip the jersey off and throw the Gatorade on him because he walked.
The other thing about this, CG, there are a lot of Los Angeles-based fans here, and I get it. My great friend Ralph Wood, etc. They are living large right now with the Dodgers coming off of a World Series appearance, the Rams off a Super Bowl appearance, though no title for either. I would be remiss if I didn't have. And the possibility, as you and I were talking last hour, that just maybe they're going to get Kawhi Leonard, although it looks a little bit more of a long shot now. That's a pretty good trifecta for the L.A. fans, so don't gloat about a five-walk win. That's all I can tell you.
You know, I want to continue talking about Kevin Durant because, you know, hopefully a lot of folks have stayed with us. But I want to go back to what you just said. Do you really believe that getting, because of the, and you're right, this was like a presidential motorcade when he landed in Toronto. When I saw the video, I had not seen it. I was focused on what you were talking about. But I my eyes glanced up to the screen, and I'm not joking. I thought, when did the President of the United States start flying on a private jet? because you've got the black Suburbans out there. And then who gets out? It's Kawhi Leonard. That was quite a scene. Do you really believe that it is a long shot? Because I'm more, I don't think it's 33, 33, 33. I really believe the Clippers are out of the picture right now. And I do believe it's if not a neck and neck race, I believe it's pretty close with Toronto and with the Lakers. And I remain convinced, and I want to hear your thought on this, I remain convinced that he knows what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think I had the example I shared with an emailer that it's kind of like the jury out when they knew the first 20 minutes what their decision was going to be in a high-profile case, and the judge went back and said, you know what, do me a favor, there's a lot of media out there. I know what your decision is, but let's negotiate for a while longer and deliberate, because it really makes us look like we're taking it seriously.
Yes.
I think this is what's going on.
I agree.
And this is just my guess of this whole thing. I know that Kawhi Leonard is an old school guy. We all know that. It's what a lot of people love about him, both on and off the court, right? In a very talkative league, he is the antithesis of it. And the me first player, he is also 180 degrees from that. That's why guys love playing with him. He likes his control. There's no doubt about it. He just goes about it in the proper way. But as much as he's an old school guy, CG, I do not see him taking that near 6-hour trip, even on a private Gulfstream, okay? I don't see him taking that just to tell the folks in Toronto that he's going to Los Angeles. Now, maybe he didn't know it was going to be the big hootie-doo it was around the hotel and everything, because evidently somebody leaked it. But he had to at least the entirety of the base of the country of Canada's looking for him. CG, I don't think he goes through all of that if he's not intending to sign the 1-1 at the very least in Toronto.
Well,
that's my guess.
Yeah, I think that is a fair point, and I think the optics of what we've seen play out today really support your position. I am going to, just for argument's sake, I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to say that because of exactly who he is that you just laid out perfectly, I do believe he feels that they treated him so well, they took him in as one of their own, and he's going to hear their final pitch and then essentially follow through with this the jury judge setup that you put out there. And I think he's going to go to the Lakers. And you know what? I'm going against everything I've said for months, Tony, because for months I said that I thought he was going to stay in Toronto. And I also said, you remember I said to you that I thought that KD was going to New York. Well, yeah, I was right, but it's the wrong borough. He's going to Brooklyn. So
well, it's the same thing. It's the old Robert Clyde line about losing the Grammys all those years. And he said it finally got to the point that all he heard was, and the winner is not Klein. All right, so all I heard was the Warriors lost. That's all I heard about KD. Okay, New York, Brooklyn, whatever, not San Francisco. That's all I heard about that.
I'm going to name drop here. You know, when I used to be, I didn't recur enough, but I was a day player on All My Children in my theater days, in my acting days. And I remember overhearing down the hall, then I come to learn later that it was Susan Lucci. She said, well, I didn't win the Emmy, but I got free dinner at Puglio's in Little Italy.
And she ended up being more popular because she didn't win. That's what longevity can do for you.
And,
right?
and for what it's worth, the absolute most delightful, loveliest person on that entire production, on that show. She when I first met her, she could not have been nicer and could not have welcomed me any more than she did, which is not quite what everybody was like on that show. I'll just tell you that. I'm going to leave it right there. But she was charming. And, of course, she's Italian. So what do you expect, right?
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. Because I've never met an Italian woman, particularly in my family, that wasn't anything but charming.
That's right.
Oh, boy.
That's right. Well, you know,
I got through it.
I've told stories about my grandmother from the region that was Sparta that carried a switchblade in her purse. So, people didn't believe me until they heard it go at a dinner somewhere. Tony, I want to go back to Marshall's email, and I want to throw this into your court now. Because to remind folks, Marshall talked about Kevin Durant being this great, talented player, and certainly, and he had a cute nickname for him, calling him not KD, but K-Diva. That's very clever. But then he said he's not some high school kid. He's a grown man in his 30s, responsible for creation, fostering of his own reality. He needs to start owning up to that cold, hard fact. That's how personal happiness or fulfillment is ultimately achieved. I said I'm not so worried about that personal happiness and fulfillment because right. I think that he has a lot more of that than he lets on. I want to hear more of your thought on this, though, that you know, does in your view, does he put too much, when things go wrong, does he push too much to other people's doorsteps? And do you think down deep he is a happy guy, irrespective of when he played in Oklahoma City, when he played up the road in Golden State, and now going out to the Brooklyn Nets?
Yeah, it's really, I think everybody is confused by it. I'm not so sure there aren't people like his mom that are still confused by it. All I can go is by the guys that are close to him, and I mentioned this, that almost everything that has taken place over the last month or so has been set in motion first by Kendrick Perkins. And every time he was asked about it, Kendrick Perkins said, well, you know what, I just have that vibe. I haven't talked to KD, which meant he and KD had been in conversation. And almost, look, invariably, when somebody seems to be right every single time about what happens going forward, you tend to think they might be privy to the source of everything, right?
Yeah.
When you hear, when he drops the hint that there was something about the relationship with the fan base and Steph Curry, and then it comes out that Kevin had said at one point, I can't believe I'm playing a distant second fiddle as great as I am to Steph Curry. When you hear there were issues with Steve Kerr from Perkins, and then suddenly that comes out, I start to wonder if he isn't using messengers, which is okay. It's the guy with burner accounts, as you know, with
his
Twitter accounts. But the other thing is, and this is where I am confused by Chris Haynes, our good buddy here from Fresno, who runs the basketball stuff for Yahoo. He's as close to KD as anybody in the media. Even Chris sometimes tells me he can't get a read on KD. But when Steve Nash, who, as you know, has been a consultant with the Warriors, says that he visited with Durant after the first title, and he said, here's Kevin in that huge house, and just got the title, and he said he was morose. He was unhappy. He was depressed that the things he thought he would get from that title, he didn't get. I've told you, I've always thought it's a quest for fulfillment that he's been looking for forever. Ramona Shelburne, who's a great writer, as you know,
she's fantastic.
She has said that he is a seeker of things, which I guess is the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Although it sounds like maybe as a seeker you are happy, but you're just looking for more, as opposed to looking for fulfillment means you're not happy at the core. Somewhere in that, the old live free or die famous potatoes. Here we go again with the license plate mottos between New Hampshire and Idaho.
Yeah.
As George Carlin said, somewhere between live free and die and famous potatoes is where life actually exists. Okay, somewhere within that spectrum is Kevin Durant's real feelings. And if he is a guy who is genuinely happy but is just looking for more, then he's making the right choice. If he's someone who is truly depressed and morose and despondent, even after all the trappings of success, then I feel for him because he's not going to find it anywhere else. He's just not. So I guess only he knows, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, it's he is the one who knows, and I guess, I don't know. I look at him, and he might be a seeker, using that terminology. And there is that element of the grass is always greener and people always looking for something better. And I guess if we believe that is the case, that he is not quite happy, then there's no amount of money that's ever going to make him happy, is there?
No, there's not. But the thing about being a seeker, and this is what's so interesting about Ramona's view, and I am going to, when she has some time, she used to play softball, by the way, at Stanford, and played right next to Jessica Mendoza. They were part of the Stanford outfield. I'd like to say when I was in college, but I wasn't in college in the early 2000s. I was calling games, but I wasn't. Like, I don't think I want to say, Ramona, were you playing in 1975?
Yeah.
That'll be the end of the conversation.
That's right.
But when she brings up that Kevin is a seeker, her point is that he's a world traveler. He likes to interact with other people that he sees that are different than he, that this is why he likes San Francisco, which, as you know, is much like New York, a very European town, right? L.A. is not. L.A. is a whole bunch of suburbs put together, right? L.A. is a great big freeway. San Francisco and Kevin live downtown. You can walk and talk to people. The same in New York. You know, he's a guy who spent a lot of time in Europe, in Africa, etc. He is someone who is a seeker of information, there's no doubt. I just don't know if that is a fulfilled guy who just, as I said, wants more from his life, or someone who, through all of it, with every single thing he does and every accolade, somehow he still feels like he isn't at his core happy. And I don't, I had a friend who found a religion that was not necessarily a mainstream religion, and his mother was not pleased about it. And I bumped into her one time. It was a childhood friend, one of my best friends growing up. Hadn't seen her in a while. And I said, "Dorothy, how's Mark?" And she said, "Ah, he thinks he's happy." That was one of the greatest lines of all time. Just think about that. Let that one settle in. He thinks he's happy. I know what she meant. She meant temporarily he's fulfilled, but in reality it's going to hit him right between the eyes. But when you take it literally, CG, he thinks he's happy. If he thinks he's happy, then by road he's happy, right?
I think so.
I just thought it was a great line. It should be somewhere etched in stone, I think.
Yeah.
He thinks he's happy.
The only other time, you know, I was thinking about your live free or die, but I want to switch to one more thing. But I was thinking of a good friend of mine, born and raised in Brooklyn, and he moved to Baton Rouge for a while. And he got the Louisiana license plate, which says Sportsman's Paradise on it. And I just remember being with him, and he said, he goes, "You know, I tell you, I went down there and I got the license plate, and I was at the DMV, and I saw it, and they said to me, 'Yeah, we're the Sportsman's Paradise.'" And he said, "Is it? Is it really? Why is that?" And I just thought. And I thought, well, I guess a New Yorker would think that, because they don't realize the fishing and what have you, but. I mean, is it? I don't think of the word paradise in Louisiana in the same sentence. It never occurred to me.
Well, Carlin had a great line when he talked about "Live Free or Die" being on the license plate motto for New Hampshire, and Carlin said, "I don't want to live anywhere where they mention death on the license plate."
Oh, heck yeah!
But you know, look, the bottom line with Durant that I'm really confused about, okay, is that if he were this truly unhappy the whole time, then either the Warriors were blind to this, or they were ill-prepared for it, or they did everything they could, and then the injury meant that there was this rekindling of brotherhood and camaraderie and all of that, and it lulled the Warriors into thinking that KD might have had a change of heart. I can't believe if he was this genuinely upset with the organization, and I'm not even talking about, you know, coming back, feeling pressure, what have you, because I'm sure, CG, that's part of the email. Okay, the fact that we kind of got the subliminal deal that it was the Warriors' fault he came back. As Kawhi proved, if you're not ready to play as an adult, it's up to you to say you can't play.
No.
Right? Nobody should be pressuring you to play. If you can't play, you can't play. I agree with that. As far as the rest of the peripheral stuff, whether it was Draymond or Steve Kerr or whatever it is, the Warriors should have been very aware of this, right? I mean, is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about it. And I know we're going to be able to pursue this more on Friday. And I guess along these lines, in our remaining moments, Tony, I wanted to take not an off-ramp, but in this same area about KD, because I wanted to ask you, we've heard kind of the yin and yang come out of New York. We've heard the reasons why the Knicks in their spin control and the people they've signed, like, you know, Taj and Julius Randle and some others, that it was a good thing, it's going to be great for them, they're hitting a couple singles and doubles, and they're going to be back on track soon. And the other side of that coin is, no, they completely failed, and the reason they failed is because nobody wants to go to such a dysfunctional organization, and the dysfunction of that organization now completely eclipses the fact that you get the world's most famous arena. Guys don't even want to play there anymore. Do you think the Knicks completely bombed, or do you think that, well, they struck out with KD and Kyrie, but they saved some face by some of the players they signed?
I think they're taking a direction of building a foundation first, which for Knicks fans that are looking back to 1973 in the last title, they're saying, boy, we're spending an awful lot of time trying to build a foundation. I will say this. and I don't know how much James Dolan is the problem. I know diehard New Yorkers say he's all the problem. Other people say in reality he's too busy with his singing career. And you and I talked about this. It was daddy's money. It was his dad who was the cable magnate that caused all this to happen. The one lesson to be learned here, and it has to do with what's going on with the Lakers right now. After Jerry Buss passed away, and you are acutely aware of it, CG, dysfunction has ruled the day with the Lakers. Yet, LeBron decided to come there anyway. That resulted in AD coming there. And if Kawhi does come there, or even he doesn't, but if he does, the Lakers more than land on their feet. So they very quickly wipe away dysfunction and become the new super team. If for some reason Antetokounmpo were to decide to do the same thing in 2021, the same thing applies in New York. They have the one built-in advantage, and that is they are New York, they are the Knicks, and if they draw the key player the way the Lakers did, as opposed to Milwaukee or a Minnesota or whatever, they can erase all the negativity in the matter of a couple of weeks. And so I think you always hang on to that if you're a Knicks fan. I know it's been a long time between drinks of water, but they're that one player away.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. Folks, Tony Diodato comes on my program every Monday at 3. What time do you come on Mondays? At 3:35. Then I come on with him Wednesdays at 2:35. And then when we see fit to have an emergency segment, we will just mix and match during the course of the week because we have that power, Tony.
Well, that's what the summer is for, CG. When September gets here, that's probably not going to be the case, but we are certainly right now invoking every bit of leeway when there's something meaningful going on.
Friday, Tony and I at 3:05 will preview the World Bog Snorkeling Championships in England.
Candlepin Bowling, Greyhound Racing in Portland, Maine, coming up this Friday.
You know, Frisbee Golf, that doesn't get enough mention.
It's big. It's huge. It's huge. No doubt about it. In the basket, as I always say.
Absolutely. And nothing like a good game of jarts.
provided you have steel-toed boots on. Otherwise, jarts can become very unnerving when it lands in the front of your foot.
Yeah, those things sail, and they get out of control sometimes, and that's troubling.
You don't want the guy in charge of the jarts that also was in charge of the keg.
That's what
I'm telling you.
That's okay. Never a good thing. He's Tony Diodato. Tony, have a great and safe July 4th. Safe trip to L.A., and we'll talk on Friday.
You too, CG. I'll see you, my friend.
All right. Coming up, we are going to switch gears here and a very special Wednesday appearance by Elite Film Mind. If you've never heard him, now you get him. He is terrific from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Nick Shager, this is the CGP.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
You know, I look up at the clock and I see it's 3:34 and 20 seconds. It's Wednesday. The sun's out. It's 130 degrees. Like, what the heck is Nick doing here now? But it is a special, it's a rare Wednesday appearance of the best film critic in the business, our guy Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Nick, how are you, my friend?
Happy Wednesday, Christopher. It is a little odd to be speaking on a Wednesday, but, everyone's got, vacation plans for the holiday, so... Now's as good a time as ever.
Well, I agreed, and I thank you for coming on with us nearly in prime time out in the New York metropolitan area. And we're not gonna lead with this, but you won't get off before 4 o'clock today without talking about the Celtics. Because for those of you who've never heard Nick before, we talk sports with Nick all the time. He is a diehard Yankees fan and a Celtics fan, which right off the bat we might have lost some listeners right there. But. We'll get to that in a minute, and I know the love affair with Kyrie, it's over. Let me ask you about that right real quickly. How do you feel about Kyrie? You knew Kyrie was leaving.
I'm thrilled about Kyrie leaving.
Oh, wow.
As I think just about every Celtics fan is at this point. And
wow.
I think that getting Kemba is a great pickup. I think he's going to be a much better fit. I think the team needed to sort of add through subtraction. So in general, I like what they've done, although I think the Horford loss is going to hurt them. We'll see. It's really going to depend on, Tatum and Brown stepping up and becoming the stars people expect them to be. And that remains to be seen.
You know, there's a great Twitter, and you're very familiar with it, Freezing Cold Takes. And if we found the audio, we have the audio of you when you got Kyrie. You were excited. I mean, you were genuinely excited. But it does show, and you're not flip-flopping, it does show what happens when a player of his caliber or any caliber you think is going to do great, and for whatever reason, the mix of players, the combo platter of the coach, the head coach, the coaching staff, it just never gels. It's like a relationship where you have the best intentions, but for some reason or other, it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think it looked great on paper. Everybody was ready for Kyrie to do what he said he wanted to do, which was step up and be the leader of a team. And I don't think he didn't try. I just think that whether it's him personally, whether it was the mix of guys on the team, whether it was too many guys on the team, whether it was complications from Hayward's injury, I just think it didn't work. And so it's better to just, you know, cut ties and find a new path. And I think they're on the right path. Whether or not it's going to pan out, as I said, we'll see.
So we segue from sports to movies. Both are filled with drama. Both are filled with highs and lows. And both are viewed and reviewed by critics, some fans, some, in this case, Nick Shager. We start with Spider-Man Far From Home. And, I mean, I've wondered, where has Marissa Tomei been? What happened to Zendaya? Michael Keaton, where have you been? And, of course, there's you know, others. Is this going to satisfy Marvel film fans, or is it going to deflate a little bit?
I think that people are going to be very happy this July 4th if they're looking forward to a new Spider-Man movie. Spider-Man Far From Home opened today, or I guess maybe it was yesterday, actually, for the holiday weekend. It's going to be the big film of the weekend. And, you know, it is also sort of an important film when it comes to the Marvel Universe, because we just earlier this year, this summer actually, had Avengers Endgame, which is, you know, the second biggest movie of all time. And this film actually is sort of the bookend to that film, and in fact, the bookend to the entire phase of Marvel films that they've been making over the last couple of years. This one follows Spider-Man in the wake of the Avengers Endgame events, going on a class trip to Europe with his classmates and trying to sort of take a break from being Spider-Man, which, as you might imagine, doesn't work out. He winds up being enlisted to help fight a series of sort of elemental monsters alongside a new hero played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who comes to be known as Mysterio. And I'm not going to give away anything that happens, but the film is very much like its predecessor, you know, sort of straddling the line between a high school teen comedy and a big budget special effects extravaganza. I think that it works best as a teen comedy, but there are some very good elements to it. The first scene is really great. The post-credit scenes, which Marvel is so famous for, are really great in this one. The first post-credit scene is maybe the best scene in the entire film. Gyllenhaal is great. Tom Holland is good. I don't think it is a great Marvel movie. It lags a bit. It sort of, you know, is a little sluggish in the middle. But overall, fans who are looking forward to this are going to think that it is definitely a worthy entry, especially because it's better than the first Spider-Man movie with Tom Holland. So if you're looking for the superhero movie of the weekend, I mean, can't go wrong with this one.
But you brought up something that I don't think you and I have ever talked about, and that is the whole post-credit deal. Or, you know, something that goes on there, and the extra films, the scenes. It used to be outtakes, and now these have gotten much more elaborate. Two things for you, Nick. Do you recall, because I don't, when this actually started in earnest, and is as much thought put into these as it seems is put into these?
Oh, yeah. Well, to answer the second question first, a ton of thought is put into them. And I think that really you can trace the beginning of this trend to Marvel themselves. I mean, we have certainly had scenes in, you know, in the credit sequences that are hidden there. And we've certainly had the blooper reels and the outtakes. That's been a longstanding tradition. But it was really with Iron Man in 2008 that Marvel put a post-credit scene in that teased a future film. And that was all designed over the first few Marvel movies to tease the build-up to the Avengers, where they were going to link all these movies, and they did so through the post-credit scenes. And that was really sort of a comic booky thing to give you a cliffhanger and to tease the next installment, the next episode. And it's become such a phenomenon that Marvel certainly can't get away from it. And a lot of other people have tried to copy to lesser success. But, you know, as people will see here in this one, I mean, Marvel is the best at it. And there's no reason for you to leave as soon as the film officially ends. You know, when I saw the movie, everybody sat in their seats. So, yeah, definitely stick around when you see Spider-Man this weekend.
And the film industry has trained us, right? They've trained us to do that. When I see people getting up at the end of a movie, it's like, well, where are you going? You know something's coming here.
That's not only is that true, Christopher, when I went and re-saw Avengers Endgame, which does not have a post-credit scene, I went and saw it with one of my kids. And when we were in line for the movie, the people, the ushers, were actually yelling at people who were going into the theater, telling them there's no post-credit scene, so leave as soon as possible. And get people out of there. And they knew people were so trained, as you said, that they were going to sit there for another 10 minutes. So, it's definitely a different world.
That's crazy. Folks, if you've never heard Nick before, because you don't catch our Friday morning program, this is Nick Shager. He joins us on Fridays at 8:30, 8:35, and because we missed him last week because I was out, and then we're all out this week, we wanted to make sure that we didn't miss Nick with a big weekend film openings. And, of course, Spider-Man opened yesterday. Nick is with the Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Variety, Esquire, and a whole bunch of other publications. So I'm going to admit to you, and you can laugh if you like, when I saw Midsommar, when I first saw the name, I saw the spelling, but I saw Midsommar, and I'm thinking, huh. I wonder if this is somehow loosely based on A Midsummer Night's Dream. And then I saw Travel to a Swedish Pagan Festival, and I thought, maybe not.
No, it's a little different than Shakespeare, for sure. Midsummer is the other big movie this weekend. People will know the director, Ari Aster, from last year's big horror hit Hereditary, which most critics and a lot of audiences really loved. I have to admit, I was on the outside of that. I didn't like Hereditary. And so this is his big follow-up. And I have to admit, it is better than Hereditary, to my mind. It still has a lot of problems, though. It's a 2.5-hour movie about a couple on the rocks that decides to go to a Swedish pagan sort of ritualistic festival, in part because a couple of the people are going to be doing thesis projects on it. But the real issue here is that the couple, played by Jack Rayner and Florence Pugh, the latter of whom is really great in this movie, they're on the rocks, they're really having problems, and they go to this festival, and this festival turns out to not be what it seems. Now, people who've seen Hereditary or have seen other sort of folk horror movies like The Wicker Man or even the more recent Apostle will really have a good idea of where this is headed, which is not good places. There's a lot of creepy things going on in the endless daylight in Sweden. I thought the movie, like Hereditary, just isn't that scary. Now, I know that, you know, is a subjective thing, but to my mind, it, again, has a problem with originality. And here, if you've seen movies like The Wicker Man, you completely know where we're headed from the beginning. What is good about this movie is that it's also a surprisingly funny movie about couples on the rocks and about breaking up and the difficulty of breaking up from both sides of a strained relationship. So I do think there's something to warrant going, you know, a reason to go see this, because there are really some good qualities to it. And there is some really horrifying imagery. There's a really crazy ending I will not even try to describe. But overall, I just think that, you know, if you really love Hereditary, you may be on this one's wavelength. For me, I just don't see what all the fuss is about the director, and I wouldn't recommend it personally.
Well, that's for coming from you, Mr. Horror Guy. That is saying something. So Spider-Man and Midsommar are the appetizers. You'll see what I'm doing here. To the good, the bad, and the hungry. That's a little lame, but I had to go there. I spent 45 minutes writing that. It's airing tonight on ESPN. It is a 30 for 30, and it's about Nathan's hot dog eating contest. I have been to one. I have been to one of those once. This is going to center around the big rivalry between Kobayashi and Joey Chestnut. A couple of things about this. Not that you're going to tell us about the 30 for 30. But I'm going to tell you my thoughts on the whole eating thing. Somebody asked me today is it a sport? And I said, you know, a lot of things are viewed as sports today that I think are maybe taking liberty with the term sports. I don't see this as a sport. Number one, I don't see it as a sport. Number two, I can barely watch them stuff this food in their mouth. You know, first of all, every time I watch Kobayashi and Joey Chestnut, it's like going to a Greek wedding. I mean, it's just because that's what the reception is like. It's just might as well just put the food in the trough. And for the Greeks listening to us, I'm Greek, so I can say that. Now, that aside, is are we going to get some depth behind Joey Chestnut and Kobayashi as to what is really behind all this?
Well, you know, we've discussed 30 for 30s a number of times over the years, and I am a big fan of the 30 for 30 series. I think that by and large, they do a fantastic job with these stories. And this one is really the same as a lot of the others. It's a very strong documentary that really does get at a lot of stuff besides just showing you the sort of bare bones craziness of the competitions themselves. As you said, the focus is on the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, which means it's really the story of Kobayashi, who in 2001 became this sensation by developing this new technique and setting all of these records eating hot dogs. And then his rivalry with Joey Chestnut has gone on to become the greatest competitive eater of all time. I mean, he's won 11 of the last 12 contests, and he keeps setting records. He set the new record last year. We'll see what he does tomorrow at the latest contest. Luckily for me, the reason I was so excited about this documentary is not because I'm fascinated by competitive eating, but I got to speak to Kobayashi at length on Monday for the Daily Beast. And what's so interesting about that is it really shows you sort of the mindset of competitive eaters and also the crazy drama that went into this story, because Kobayashi, as many people will know, eventually left Major League Eating, and he had this big falling out with George Shea, who runs the contest, and he and Joey Chestnut don't get along. They're actually fighting on Twitter via my article as we speak. And so, you know, I think that if you're interested in this, it is a fascinating study of this subculture. As to your point about whether it's a sport or not, certainly they consider themselves athletes. I certainly think there is a competitive aspect to this, of course, because they are competing. Whether it's an athletic competition of some sort, I think is a debatable point. And it certainly is disgusting, as you said. There's no way to watch it without thinking it's a little bit gross. So I think it's sort of, you know, in a different realm than sports, per se.
Yeah. So, Nick, you did say a moment ago that you had a chance to speak at length with Kobayashi. Did you get any sense from him as to any time, and I ask this seriously, that when he or his other competitors, I mean, have they ever had medical issues where they are putting so much food into their system that, you know, the human body can only take so much? I don't care how big you are, how great your system is, it can only take so much. Have they ever had issues with that? Because I've asked Andrew Zimmern that, from Bizarre Foods. I used to co-host with him and produce his show. And all the places that he would go, he had to go to the Mayo Clinic once. I mean, he's had issues eating certain things. What did Kobayashi, if anything, say about that?
He had nothing to say about the medical issues. I did ask him, and he sort of skirted the issue. Certainly, Kobayashi, one of the reasons he was so unique in this field was because he was such a small little guy when he first burst on the scene. And then after that, he became this very muscular, ripped guy. I mean, he still has a 12-pack, which seemed totally incongruous to the fact that he was eating 60-plus hot dogs in 10 minutes. He's still in great shape. He still seems to be in good health. But I have to imagine that there's some negative effect to this, both in the immediate aftermath of these eating contests and long term. But, you know, he and Chestnut, they claim they're in good health. That's about as far as I can go with it.
Before we take a pause here, was there something that he said that really just surprised you or shocked you about this whole genre of eating contests?
Well, I think the most surprising thing was how angry he came off about the contest in general, and about the fact that one of the reasons he was so angry about it, and this was surprising, was one of his big beefs with George Shea, the promoter of the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, who comes off in the documentary like a real carnival barker, who really sort of admits that he's a shameless huckster. Kobayashi sort of came out and said that he was a con man and he scripts a lot of the stuff and that he makes up the rules as they go along. So it really gave you a perspective on the fact that you can't really trust the contest, even though you see the meeting these things. There's a lot more shadiness going on than maybe meets the eye.
Well, that's this is airing tonight on ESPN. It's 30 for 30, and you've heard Nick and I talk about 30 for 30s on ESPN. They are as well done as anything you're going to find in major film houses or on television. They manage to take what seems like a simple subject, and again, Nick pointed this out. They give you nuance. They give you depth. I will say this. Give me a Chicago dog, and I'm biased, any time over Nathan's. I'm just going to say that right now. Coming up, one more thing with Nick today, and it's going to be Stranger Things. Yeah, Stranger Things coming up next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
I'm going to correct myself. I said it starts tonight. The good, the bad, the hungry, 30 for 30, the latest from ESPN. It premiered last night, so my apologies there. We are visiting with Nick Shager from Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Variety, Esquire. Stranger Things, fourth season, that premieres tomorrow. I do have that date right. I know you're not going to give much away, but this is a hugely popular series. Do you like? Have you seen some of the new series? What can you tell us?
I have seen new episodes of the series, not the entirety of season 3 here, which premieres tomorrow. But yes, Stranger Things is, if not for Spider-Man, I think Stranger Things would be the big deal of the July 4th weekend because, you know, Stranger Things is really, I would argue, as big a phenomenon on Netflix as anything on streaming sites anywhere. And, you know, we haven't had a season for a year and a half. Season 2 ended or came out, I believe, at the very end of 2017. So anticipation has been running real high, and I'm happy to report that from what I've seen so far, season 3 is actually an improvement on season 2. And I think it may be, depending on how it ends, as good as the first season as well. I'm not going to give anything away. In fact, as I was telling you, and I've told my kids as well, who are big-time fans, Netflix has released a list when they sent out screeners of everything you can't give away. And it's basically everything. I can't give away almost anything, but I can tell you that all the kids are back, that the kids are a bit older, that a lot of the story now revolves around a new mall that's built in their town, you know, that's in the 80s. So there's a lot of 80s nostalgia as before. The best thing about it so far, better than the new supernatural threat, better than the new human threats, is that the kids themselves are older. And I think that's allowed the storytellers, the Duffer brothers who created the show, to really do a lot more nuanced and much more interesting teen-based drama. The kids just, you know, aren't in middle school anymore. And so the storytelling, I think, has really improved in that regard. And the actors who've gotten older have gotten better. So in the final tally, you know, my kids are going to be staying up real late tonight waiting for it to premiere. I know they're going to be spending too much time tomorrow, unless I can help it, watching it on TV as well. You know, if you're a big Stranger Things fan, you have a lot to look forward to. It's as good as anything that's coming out this weekend. And as I said, I think it may be the best of the bunch so far.
I'll just say this. We'll close with this. My two daughters, ages 12 and the older one turning 16, they both know very much about you. The older ones read some of your reviews. And whenever I tell them about a movie that's more designed for young people, now I get looks from them like, what did Nick think? Because you know, they haven't always agreed with your reviews. So as much as they – and they're doing it teasing mostly. But what is it like with your kids? Because there's got to be times when – we got about a minute left. There's got to be times when your kids kind of look at you and go – come on, what do you mean you didn't like this film?
Oh, yeah. If you think that I get a lot of blowback from regular readers and listeners, certainly I get the most blowback from my family, including my kids, who, it will surprise nobody to hear, are extremely opinionated, including when it comes to things like movies and TV shows, especially if they love them. So, no, we have a lot of disagreements, but in general, you know, it turns out, I guess not too surprisingly, that we're on the same wavelength. And when it comes to something like Stranger Things, I was actually a fan of the show when it first came out, but they became much bigger fans because it's targeted right at them. And so, you know, we like to have critical discussions, but, you know, I think they understand that they don't have to, you know, agree with me all the time. And certainly I don't feel like I have to agree with them. It's a nice combative relationship, let's say.
Well, I think it's cool. I think it's cool that you involve them and they get a chance to really, you know, learn about what you do and to develop their own, you know, critical thinking skills. That's good stuff. He is also good stuff. Nick Shager, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Variety, Esquire. Nick, always a great pleasure. Have a safe and great 4th. We will see each other a week from Friday.
Yes, enjoy Independence Day. A happy July 4th to everybody, and I'll speak with you in a week and a half.
Fantastic. Nick Shager, folks. Coming up, we go to Denver, the award-winning morning host on KOA News Radio. We call him Mile High Megamind, Marty Lenz. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
From the studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California, this is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number 2, CGP, your July 4th special, which some of you might wonder, because we haven't talked about July 4th yet. We will. Hour 2 begins right now, 5 minutes, 37 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. We're coming up a little short today. We'll end at 5:30, give way to the Giants pregame show, Giants taking on the San Diego Padres. Well, we will get to some July 4th stuff coming up in the next couple of minutes because Mile High Megamind is here.
The Mountain West Conference has never been the same since this former wide receiver graduated from Colorado State. He holds the all-time season and career reception marks for... Wait. Sorry, no. That was a different receiver. Never mind then. Here's Marty Lenz.
This would be a $5 fine calling you Mile High Mega Hind. It's not Mega Hind, it's Mega Mind. Marty Lenz, award-winning host for KOA News Radio, former wide receiver, Colorado State. How are you, my friend?
I'm fine. Reminds me of the joke that they used to talk about in Canada Day. It was a couple days ago, and they'd say, Moose Jaw, where's Moose Jaw? And they'd say, well, it's 6 feet from the moose's, you know what.
That's exactly right. So that's a small fine on my show, what I just did. So let's just move over. I want to jump right in. We've been talking so much NBA lately on my program, and I know that it's certainly on the minds of you guys out there with the Denver Nuggets, a fine team, and certainly a team that will do well next year. And I was thinking about going back a few years back, what was it, 2011 or thereabouts, when Chris Paul was going to go to the Lakers, and then David Stern stepped in and said no, he vetoed the trade. You had the Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cavaliers, writing to David Stern saying it would be a travesty to allow the Lakers to acquire Chris Paul in the apparent trade being discussed. I know the vast majority of owners feel the same way I do. Eventually, the trade was vetoed, as you well know, Marty, and David Stern and the league came out and insisted that the league was, the decision was made, quote, free from the influence of other NBA owners, that the team was better served with Chris in a Hornets uniform than by the outcome of the terms of that trade. Let's fast forward to how that played out then, and there's more to it than what we're giving here, but that really is the upshot of it. And you look to now, and you see a couple of years ago KD going to the Golden State Warriors, you see LeBron going to the Lakers, KD, but more importantly, Kawhi possibly going to the Lakers. Who knows what the flying to Toronto means today. So, do you believe, and I ask this with no agenda, because I don't know where you stand on this, do you believe the NBA should step in, as many fans of smaller market teams insist, to prevent super teams?
I don't think so, just because it's the reality currently of the NBA. I mean, a lot of these. You look at the Pelicans. The fact that essentially they become like a JV or a B league team eventually for bigger teams. I mean, they lose Anthony Davis. Look, I'd love to see more parity in the NBA. But it does go to show, too, that smaller markets, and I always point to San Antonio, can win championships if they have the right infrastructure, the right coach, the right investment. So a lot of times these smaller market teams, and mind you, yeah, maybe they can't spend as much for whatever reason, but it's not always indicative, because then you can point to the Lakers. The Lakers have been sucky for how long now? Now, they might get good again, might get great again, and we could argue that the Lakers being good is good for the league, and it's probably more important for the Lakers to be good than for Memphis or for New Orleans or one of the other, you want to say, mid-market, mid-level teams is. But the fact is, you can win as a small market team, but you got to be savvy about it. And so, no, I don't think they should interfere with that. I think if you abide by the rules and you can amass talent and you're playing within the salary cap, then no. The rules are the rules, because it goes to show, just because you spend a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to get your benefits for it. And, you know, you can also point to the Knicks. Everybody talks about the Knicks wanting to be relevant, and they've been terrible for how long? And they're in a basketball crazy city, a world class city, and they can't get out of their own way. So no, I don't like when people interfere with these kind of moves. So what they should have let Chris Paul do the move years ago. And I'm hoping they learn from that lesson. They don't interject anymore.
Well, I'm going to offer you a parallel, and I agree with you. I agree with you, but I'm going to offer you a parallel of an article that I remember reading some time back, and the long and short of it was they were talking about the article was talking about the state of Vermont and about how you have Route 91 that comes into Vermont, and you have 95 that goes into Vermont, and you have 93 that goes into New Hampshire. But you have these big routes that go in, and these smaller towns in Vermont, these very Charles Dickens-like towns. I'm not sure if you've been to Vermont, but it's a beautiful state. And all these adorable towns with these mom-and-pop stores that had been there forever, and many of these stores, and to some extent, a lot of these towns have either been closed down or redone, or in some cases just kind of wiped out because of big-box stores coming in and putting those big box stores closer to the freeway so that people could get to them in and out without any problems, parking spaces, and they didn't need to go to the mom-and-pop stores anymore. And I read a piece that was trying to equate that with the NBA and having super teams. The difference is when you look at the longevity or the life cycle of players in the NBA, what becomes a super team for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years is often and usually not going to last, and the cycles of great teams becoming poor teams getting great, is going to be vastly different, Marty, than a town that once a big box store goes there, it's unlikely that that store is going to leave and those mom and pop stores are going to be able to come back. I don't have any problem with the rich getting richer, because all it takes is a player or two to decide we want to go to that team to do something special and can change the fortunes of the entire franchise.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the best analogy, but I'll add to that. So when people think of Vermont, the first thing they don't think of is Costco, or they don't think of Home Depot. They think of Vermont to get away to the beauty, right? Well, when you think of the NBA, you don't think of Memphis or New Orleans. I'll even throw in there, you don't think of Portland maybe. But you think of the Lakers, you now think of Golden State, you used to think of the Bulls, you think of those franchises. Those attract the eyeballs. So just like when people travel to Vermont, they're not thinking about going there shopping necessarily. They're thinking about hanging out there and taking the experience of a beautiful place in Vermont, thinking maple syrup, thinking maybe some skiing in the season. In the NBA, when they want to watch a game, there's not a lot of people clamoring to say, I want to see when, the Memphis Grizzlies play the Pelicans. So the attractiveness is not necessarily about, if you want to say, the mechanism of that team. Attractiveness is the overall. Why do you go to Vermont? You go there because of the beauty. You don't go there to shop. Why do you go to the NBA? You go to watch probably the mega market legendary teams to play, and if they happen to be playing one of those teams, then great. But they're not. But the Memphises and the Pelicans are not an attraction. So maybe that's where that analogy, where I would draw it out necessarily even further. Again, the NBA has struggled of all the major sports. There's probably the least amount of parity exists probably in the NBA, maybe followed by Major League Baseball. Hockey's got really good parity. You never know who's going to win the Stanley Cup. NFL does a really good job of parity. I mean, you could throw the Patriots out of there, but that the Patriots are the exception to the rule, and they prove that everybody else has a puncher's chance to get into the Super Bowl if they can get by the Patriots, whoever else, and on the NFC. NBA has struggled with that, but I think that's partly because the NBA in many ways has become a more regional sport, except for a handful of teams that draw national attention. And I got to tell you, as a sports fan, if I'm again, we'll take the Christmas Day example. On Christmas Day, they're not putting the Pelicans or Grizzlies. I keep bringing those two teams up because if we're kind of, unless they have a marquee player. You know, back in the day, you would have gotten San Antonio, but that's because they had Tim Duncan and Kawhi or the major there. But that's it. I mean, that's just the attraction piece of it. So that's the problem with the NBA. And again, I just don't like any commissioner or league interfering unless it's set up. And that's why you have, you know, the worst teams get the best chance at the draft picks, because you hope that levels off and you hope you have management that does a good job of trying to keep people. Again, San Antonio was a great example of once they got rolling, they were able to keep people. They kept a great coach. They had a great infrastructure, still do, and were able to keep guys. So it can be done, but it's not easy, but it can be done. And just like having all the money in the world doesn't guarantee you a great team. And again, we looked at the Lakers for years. They were terrible. They may be great again, but they've got Golden State's going to come back to the pack. You never know. But I don't like the interference. I don't like trying to make things fair and equal. Doesn't always work that way. It has a bad history of that.
And it's also, you look at the ages of fans. Just look at kids right now who are, I don't know, 19, 20, 21 years old. They weren't born yet when the Bulls were a super team to the extent that they were wiping out everybody else in the NBA, winning 6 titles in 8 years. Those kids today who are 20 years old, 21 years old, the Bulls of this past season were 22 and 60. The Bulls of last year were 27 and 55. So when they hear about Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman, Horace Grant, Steve Kerr, and company, Scottie Pippen, they're not seeing a team or a franchise that was a super team by any stretch of the imagination. They hold no more level of superiority and greatness as a franchise as looking back to the Celtics of the 80s or the Lakers and Celtics from generations past. And I think, you know, a super team becomes a super team based upon who is there right now. And Golden State next year is more than likely going to be positively ordinary by their standards. They're probably going to be about a 45-win team when you look at it, maybe 50, but they're not going to be a 65, 67-win team. They're not going to be featured on Christmas Day. They're not going to be the team that you're watching on, you know, on special Friday night NBA games and so on. I think a lot of it just turns into the cycles, and we tend to react and overreact in the given moment, not realizing or not remembering that 2 years from now or 3 years from now, it can be entirely different.
Right, and here's where the NBA is different. Having said everything I said, the NBA is better about marketing their superstars, and that is where there's a difference. So, again, using my Pelicans analogy, they will get airtime because people want to see Zion Williamson. They don't give a rat's hiney about the Pelicans, but they want to see Zion play. So they're going to tune in to see him play. Just like LeBron could go to any team, people are going to tune in to watch LeBron. Just so happens he's with the Lakers now, so that's an added benefit. But when LeBron was in Cleveland, they tuned in to see LeBron. When he was in Miami, they tune in to see LeBron. You use Golden State. They'll still probably tune in to see Steph Curry and see what Golden State is, because superstar players will still have that appeal. People tuned in to watch Toronto because of Kawhi Leonard. That's the one thing the NBA does better. It's some things they do worse at than other pro sports, but they do better at marketing superstars. So that's going to help. It's a star-driven league. It's more – I would even argue this. The NBA is more star-driven than it is team driven. So if you want to take the analogy of should the NBA interfere to try to spread out the stars, I still don't like that. But maybe they figure, well, the team maybe isn't good, but if they have a superstar that can elevate them, then more people will watch the Pelicans or the Trailblazers or San Antonio or, you know, name your team that's not in a top 10 market, the Nuggets, someone like that. They'll be interested in them because they have a star player that people just want to see because that star is so compelling.
Well, and you know, looking at KD and Kyrie going to the Nets, for the longest time, my attitude about that was, listen, they're not going to want to go to the Nets because there is something special, and there is something special about playing in Manhattan, playing at Madison Square Garden. But you know what? I'm going to rethink that, because the reality now is that I think the players are saying, yeah, that may be true. There's no more electric arena in the NBA and maybe in all of sports in terms of hockey and basketball than Madison Square Garden. But if you're going to play in the blue and orange of the Knicks, That means you have to be a part of the hierarchy that is one of the most dysfunctional organizations in all of sports. And they chose the stability and the far better leadership and ownership of the Brooklyn Nets. And so it is. You're right. Kyrie and KD understand. They decided, listen, I'm sure they were texting like crazy, and we're going to be a package. We're going to go, you know, we talked about this on my show the other day, that KD was probably originally driving the bus, and then when he got injured, it was more Kyrie who was driving the bus, but they had decided they're going to go together. They like the idea of being in the New York metropolitan area. They're not going to be, the Brooklyn Nets will never get the kind of electric pub that the New York Knicks will get, but I think with the players, they understand we want to win a championship. We can do so in New York, and we don't have to play for an organization that's just, you know, that can't find their way in and out the front door.
Right, and in addition, now people actually care about Nets games. No one cared about Nets games before, but now that they have one or two of those superstars, and basically one, because we know KD is going to have a redshirt year and not play next year, people will tune in. It'll be interest to watch the Nets. Why? Because of the superstars, not because of the brand, but because of who is representing the brand.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. All right, coming up next, more with Marty Lenz. The interesting situation with Boogie Cousins, I talked about it briefly yesterday. Well, Boogie Cousins, late last night or early today, has changed agents. And I'm not sure that's going to change reality for him. And it's really a case study in how NBA players, we'll stick with the NBA part of it, how NBA players see themselves versus the reality of how other teams see them. More with Marty Lenz coming up. Coming up, this is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
We're talking with our good friend Marty Lenz from KOA News Radio. He is the award-winning host of Colorado's Morning News and former wide receiver from Colorado State when it was the WAC. Marty, Boogie Cousins has changed agents, and one of the reasons is because I guess he doesn't understand why not a single team has shown interest in him. The reason they're not showing interest in him is because the price that he's been throwing himself out there at, $10 million, $15, $20 million, teams are saying, listen, we know you're a good guy, you're a team guy, we think you can definitely produce, but we don't think you're worth that money, especially coming off that injury. You want to drop your price a little bit, we'll do that. Is this something that is more indigenous to, or I should say, more representative of where a lot of players' heads are at, Marty, that they how they see themselves is not really how the rest of the league sees them?
I'm a bit out of the loop. So is Golden State, do they want to keep him? Or they let him? Is he exploring what's the situation?
Yeah,
I got to tell you, I don't. Go ahead.
No. You're right. He's exploring what's out there. It's not by any means out of the question that he resigns with Golden State. But I think what, you know, from what we've been able to ascertain is that the money that he wants, Golden State isn't necessarily going to give him, and nobody else has as well. There was rumor that the Celtics were interested. There was rumors that the Lakers were interested. There were rumors that several teams were interested, but not at the money that his previous agent was putting out there, and that wasn't flying. And so the broader issue is when you look at NBA players in general, or look at athletes in general, one of the chasms that we get, Marty, and one of the reasons why we see guys stay unsigned for so long is we can look at baseball. You look at Bryce Harper. They're just assuming that they're going to get their number if they wait long enough. And in this case, Boogie Cousins is not a Bryce Harper. So do you think that sports, that athletes in general, need to have a little bit more of reality checks relative to their actual worth as to where they're at on their career with injuries and what have you that they've sustained and come back from?
Yeah, here's the thing. At Boogie Cousins' value, he's a great fit on an established team as either the fifth guy or sixth guy, but he's not a guy that's going to turn a franchise around. He's an addition to, he's not a one that's going to leave. So he's overestimating his value. So, for example, say he went back to Sacramento. He's not going to improve them, but if he stays in Golden State or if he goes to the Lakers, he's an addition to people that already have good depth and a good, you know, decent front line. That's where maybe he's overvaluing himself. So he's worth that price. Maybe if he goes to the Celtics, where they lost a what's his name, Horford, but he's not a
he's not a guy that you're going to – he's going to transform your franchise. And I think he has to be very careful about realizing that, that he's a good fit in because of the skills he brings. Like, he'd – I actually think he'd look really good in a Nuggets uniform too, possibly as an addition to what they have him give him scoring. But he's not going to a guy that's going to lead you to the promised land. That's just not – that's not his thing anymore. Probably never was, but definitely not now. So he may be overvaluing himself. And maybe that's why the other teams haven't offered him that money.
Marty, when owners sit back – and you know, I've talked about this forever, but you look at the baseball free agency period that we came off of where guys weren't getting signed, and one of the points that I made on the program a few days ago is maybe Major League Baseball should take a lesson from basketball where guys get signed, deals get done, and then teams have several months to actually market their team with these new players in mind. Baseball sits behind and doesn't do anything. But where does the fault lie, Marty? Does the fault lie with players and their agents simply wanting to break the bank? Does it fault with owners who are saying, you know what, somebody's got to draw a line in the sand with some of these salaries, and I'm going to be the one to do it? And then you start getting hints of collusion when oftentimes with owners, it's not collusion as much as, I mean, and, listen, baseball, professional sports owners have gone to court and lost with collusion multiple times before, but it may not be owners quietly colluding as much as it is owners getting some sort of, I don't know, conscience and maybe finding a little common sense.
Well, it's the fault of the owners to begin with because they're paying the salaries. Then what happens, they realize they're overpaying, and so then they check themselves eventually. But it's like anything else. It's what the market is willing to bear. So, you know, if Boogie is out there asking for that rate, if somebody pays it, then that's what the market bears. If it comes back and he's not, then again, that's what the market bears. So a lot of it is the fault of the owners who have the money that don't spend it or think they have to overspend. And we've talked about this before in sports. Sometimes you got to overspend because you want to keep a guy. You maybe feel like you're spending more than he's worth, but if somebody else is willing to pay that price or more, then you say, well, then it is a value because somebody was going to pay him more for his services and we like him. So it always falls on the owner. They're the ones that control the purse strings. They're the ones that sign the contracts and the deals. I mean, the player can ask for whatever they want. You know, it's the owners and the people, the money people, have to be the ones that show, if you want to say, restraint or control the market. So I always put that on them. But if no one's willing to match the offer, somebody is, then you say, well, that the market was willing to pay Boogie Cousins or whoever that rate. So that's the key. I don't blame, you know, especially when a lot of times salaries aren't guaranteed. And you know, teams, the NBA is a little different, but they can cut you, release you at any time. I don't begrudge any guy trying to get the max that he can get. So I'm not sympathetic, you know, to the owners, you know, just because they're the ones that control. They control what the market is by what they're paying and what other teams are paying and willing to pay.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think that, and you just hit the right phrase. I mean, and it sometimes becomes an overused phrase of if the market will bear it, someone's going to pay it. But that really is where it's at. And until anybody decides to put a line in the sand and say, you know what, salaries really are out of control, they're going to continue to escalate. They're just going to skyrocket. And the fact is, as soon as anybody gets this hint that maybe there's some collusion in mind, some owner out there is going to say, you know what, I can go get Marty Lentz. I can get him for a price. If I go a little bit higher, I can get him for this price.
Yeah.
And the cycle just keeps going.
Well, and let's face it, some teams that can pay more, because, again, this gets into the teams that have maybe better networks, better contracts, you know, are able to pay it because they're in larger markets and have opportunities. To them, that may not be overpaying. But $15 million, and we know this, $15 million spends different if you're a team like the Lakers than it does, say, like the Kings, because the resources that are available to you. So you don't take as big of a hit. But at the same time, if the marquee teams don't want to pay it, that also signals to the smaller teams, well, if they're not willing to pay that rate, then we sure as heck shouldn't either.
More with Marty Lentz coming up. We're going to switch sports. We're going to go to baseball. Manny Machado, Bryce Harper. I was just mentioning Bryce Harper a second ago. Not on the All-Star teams. And what does that mean? Did teams overpay for them? Well, we'll talk about that coming up next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We're done at 5:30 today. Giants and Padres send you to the pregame. Marty Lentz is my guest right now, joins us every Wednesday about 4:05. Always appreciate Marty taking some time out of his day in beautiful Denver to join us. Marty, So all of the hullabaloo, we love to use that word, over Manny Machado, where he was going to sign, he goes to the Padres, Bryce Harper. Eventually we find out he goes to the Phillies. Record-setting deals, especially Bryce Harper, neither of them make the All-Star game. So, of course, the first there's a lot of different ways to go here. And the immediate place is, the classic overreaction, did teams overpay? But there is a precedent. For what it's worth, there is a precedent here for guys signing huge contracts with a team and then not necessarily producing the way the team and the fans expect. But, you know, there's a lot of time to go in this season.
Didn't the players vote on this All-Star game this year?
Well, it's a combination of things. You had players, but you also had fans. You had the special election day with the fans voting, and so there's a combination of things here.
Okay, well, first off, I'm going to say to the fans respectfully, shut your pie hole, and here's why. Because I get frustrated, especially living in Colorado, about the crap that some Rockies players are taking for. No one's arguing Nolan Arenado, nor should they. But, and I'm personalizing this, but when they argue about Trevor Story and other guys that make it because it's the atmosphere, these new, and I'm going to say this, you millennials and you analytics geeks, you think you know atmospherics too. Here's a reality. You throw a belt-high fastball in any ballpark, it's going to get jacked. And here's the other thing, too. A field like Coors Field is huge. It's not a bandbox, and I can point to a lot of bandboxes. Fenway's not exactly a big park, okay? The reason they have to put the wall up because it's so short. So spare me your outrage about guys who make it and don't make it by all your frickin' numbers. At some point, it becomes the eyeball test. Any of these guys playing anywhere are good. Park, it maybe helps a little bit. But conversely, if you're going to rag on who makes and who doesn't, and you're going to blame the ballpark for it, I look forward to the day that people give pitchers for the Rockies the same amount of credit that they take away from Rockies hitters and batters, because nothing annoys me more than this. And, you know, you talk about just a futile argument, is arguing with fans and people about who made it, who didn't, who was overpaid. So Manny Machado, you know what, I think he's worth what they pay him. Bryce Harper, I personally think he's worth what they're paying. You know, these are good players doing a decent job. San Diego's kind of relevant. Shoot, they're 500. I think the only team under 500 in the National League West is the Giants. By the way, the best under 500 team, if I saw you tweet earlier.
That's about right. That's right.
Yeah. So I sometimes get irritated with this argument. So they don't make an All-Star game. It doesn't mean they're not valuable. To your point, if fans are putting them in, they have a say. I put a lot of stock in what players say. They play against these guys every day. They know these guys, and I think they're a pretty good judge of who should make it and who shouldn't. But I think it's hard to tie that to making All-Star games because it's too random. If it's purely on stats, then a lot of the guys that make it in probably wouldn't make it, and conversely, there's always going to be misses where you say, well, this person deserves it based on what he's done thus far in the season. But I don't know. I get really – you know, horked off with people that get so self-righteous about people, where they play and what they do in the end. You know, just shut up. How's that take?
Well, listen, it falls under the same kind of the same place that I sit, and that is I think there's an overreaction. I mean, I think there is an overreaction of fans and of a lot of media members. And listen, you and I both know, depending upon the media market, you're talking about people that are trying to get clicks, people that are trying to get people calling into shows and screaming their heads off. The fact is, these guys didn't sign for 85 games. They didn't sign for one year. They're going to be there for a while. And these are two guys that I would take either of these guys on my team anytime. So the people who are getting all bent out of shape over it, I think just need to relax and just see where the season goes first. And I would say this also. I'm just not someone who has, and maybe I am in the minority on this, but I'm just not somebody who is ever putting that much stock into an All-Star game and saying if a guy doesn't or does make the All-Star game, that immediately equates to his value. You look at Bryce Harper on the Phillies. The Phillies are 4.5 games out of first. I like where the Phillies are at right now. I mean, they've got another 77 games to go. You look at the San Diego Padres, they're 15 out because they're in the division with the L.A. Dodgers, and nobody is catching the Dodgers this year. I don't care who they
Everybody's
are.
Everybody's playing for second place in the National League West. We've even said that here in Colorado. We realize now, hey, man, unless they fall off the cliff, everybody's playing for the wild card. Absolutely. So.
Yeah, no, exactly. All right. Now, there was one thing I wanted to touch on real quickly. And you had somebody on your show. You talked about this, and I don't normally get into this stuff, but I'm gonna bring it up anyway. And that is the whole Colin Kaepernick Nike situation with the Betsy Ross American flag shoes. And I guess the question I'm gonna ask you is because you had somebody on that was saying this is a bit of a ruse from Nike that allegedly Colin Kaepernick's influence. Or he influenced Nike to cancel the sale of the flag shoes. And you had a marketing expert on saying, let's hold off on that.
Well, his Darren Duber Smith from MSU Denver, that's Metro State here in Denver, he's a great guest of ours, talks all things marketing. He says he's been watching Nike for 20 years, and this is part of their pattern. They do this all the time because they know it generates talk and buzz. So there's not an altruistic, oh, we care and we really think about it. No, it's very cold and calculating what they're doing. And he knows that. And he says it generates anger and heat. People talk about it. People protest it. But then people will go buy their stuff. You know, he's not a fan of it. He doesn't like it. He's of the opinion that any company shouldn't be taking, if it's a marching orders, it wasn't quite his words, from one of their talent or one of their people. Having said that, and I've been very clear about this, I have supported Colin Kaepernick when it came to taking a knee for the national anthem because of the reason he did it, which people conflate all the time. It wasn't anything to do with the military or the flag. It had to do with the treatment of people of color by police. Not him, but people that look like him. So I understood that. But in this case, I think Colin's wrong. I think at this point, if you think everything is racist and bad, then when something really is racist and bad, it loses its power and effect. And I think in this case, to me, it's a bridge too far. I know Nike's probably, according to our expert we had him on, said they're calculator doing this. But if they're really sincere about it, they're missing the boat on this. This is an instance where you say, you know what? This is not a hill to die in, as we like to say.
Yeah.
And it's an overreach and overreaction. So I say that this is, again, that's why I say Colin Kaepernick is an imperfect spokesperson, you know, on this issue. Things about him I think I like. Things that about him drive me nuts. This is one of those things. Just like the fact the guy doesn't vote. And I sit there and say, you don't vote, then what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to take action. So, but getting back to your main thing, our marketing guy, because that's what you asked, he said, no, this is a calculated thing by Nike. This is not something they just decided. They know the buttons to push, and they've been pushing them for two decades.
Well, I'll say this about this. Number one, the shoes themselves, I think they're great. I saw the shoes, saw them from the back, saw them from the front. I think they're great. And, you know, would I wear them? I don't wear flashy shoes like that. But if my daughters bought them for me, if they were out on the market and they said, Daddy, we want you to wear these on July 4th, I'm wearing them. I think they're really cool. As far as Colin Kaepernick goes, I've always been of multiple minds with him, and I've said that on this program, and I'll say it again, and it largely lines up with you, and that is that I understand everything that he did, but I also think sometimes that I don't care if it's Colin Kaepernick, I don't care if it's an actor, I don't care if it's a singer or an author, we often put too much stock into what one person says, no matter what he or she, whatever, matter what side he or she is on. We often put too much stock and get too swayed one way or the other over what someone says simply because we are predisposed to liking that person or disliking that person. And because of our affinity or dislike for them, that ends up becoming something that directs our opinion more than a level of objectivity.
Right. And I mean, people are.
Would you agree with that or no?
I totally do, and that's the point. I think sometimes we base too much. It's like, you know, I think we live in a world now where people feel like we have to be completely one side or completely the other. And I said, no, there's nuance to things. There's not always black and white.
Right.
There's shades of gray. And Colin Kaepernick's a guy that presents a lot of shades of gray. Things I look and say, you know, this is good he's doing. Things I look and say, man, that doesn't make sense. I don't get it. You know, I don't walk in his shoes. I've never walked in his shoes, even before he was somebody famous, so I don't know. But I scratch my head. And to me, getting back to the branding piece, if Colin Kaepernick is trying, if you want to say, brand himself with this, this hurts his brand. I think there's people look and say, come on, I can get my arms around some of the stuff you're doing, Colin, but come on, really? This is what you're going to, you know, take somewhat of offense to, however it was presented. Then I think people that even want to kind of defend him say, oh, come on, this is a bridge too far for me too. This is just ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I think that's well said, because I think what it's like the news talk or sports talk host who is doing nothing but screaming every single day. And after a while, you start, you know, I had a great host, and you know who it is, who once told me, be select in your savagery. And because if you're yelling the whole time, people start tuning you out. And when you start protesting, and again, You know, I'm not fence-sitting here. This is exactly how I feel. When you're protesting every single thing on one side of the fence or the other, after a while, there is an inability for your audience or the people who are fond of you, if they are, to really look at you and say, wait a minute, you know what? I'm not on board with you on this. Because you don't like anything. And at some point, you look at that person and say, you have to be able to distinguish between A and B at some point.
Well, you lose your credibility and you lose your power. And I think that's, in this instance, kind of what's happened with Colin.
Yeah, no, I would agree. We're talking with Marty Lenz from KOA News Radio. You know, we are thankfully approaching the college football season. And, you know, a big fan of yours in this market is the very talented Julia Lopez, also a Colorado State graduate. And sources telling me that I'm going to be appearing on her Bulldog Insider this weekend. Yeah, I know. I'm going to be appearing that on
you.
I know, throwing me on TV. They must have really had to go through a lot of names before they got to me. But as we're in July now, and I like to think of it. Maybe I'm delusional. I'm trying to tell myself that we're in the home stretch to get the football, just, you know, 7 weeks away or so. Anything that's jumping out at you as you look at the upcoming college football season, things that you're looking to see, Mountain West, who are you looking at this year? Is it going to be Fresno State? Is it going to be Utah State? Is it a resurgence from Boise State, San Diego State? What are you looking at?
Well, my first thing is, honestly, I see, can Fresno State hold serve? Can they come back and do it back-to-back years? Secondly, my opinion, I think Utah State had a great run, but I think because losing Matt Wells and everything else, I think they'll probably come back to the pack a bit. 100% bias here. I want to see if the Rams can step up this year. Sounds like they got things in place. Sounds like they've changed the culture. You know, I hear people from the inside saying it. I want to see if they can make a step forward, not only get to a bowl game again. You know, they missed one last year, went to five straight prior, but can they compete for a Mountain West title this year? Can they finally get back to where we would love them to be and we were used to seeing them for many, many years? It's been a while. That, I think Boise State's always going to be Boise State. Those are the things, the first things that come to mind to see what's going to happen. Something else, too, and you might have talked about this as well, and this has been in Mountain West circles. With Connecticut leaving to go to the Big East, finally, how many times have you and I talked about finally they need to be there? The AAC was thinking about picking up a team. Well, the rumor is they'd maybe want to pick up a few Mountain West teams.
Not happening.
I think it's crazy. It makes the league too big. And people have said, why doesn't CSU, wouldn't they be interested? And it's like, hell no. It's not going to get CSU where it eventually needs to be, which is anybody's goal more than likely is to be in a Power 5. Jumping league to league, I said, isn't going to help. I know people look at TCU, and I said, yeah, but it took a lot of iterations to TCU. And the reality is it wasn't until TCU got really good before somebody was interested in them. It wasn't the league hopping. It was that they got good. That's the issue. And they got good, and it just so happened that they became good in the latter days of the WAC and then the Mountain West. So
I did about 8 or 10 minutes the other day on the AAC, and I don't know where the report started, but there was no way that Boise State was leaving the Mountain West to go to the AAC. That just wasn't happening. Somebody tried to make the point to me about TV money, and I said, whatever TV money difference there is between the American and the Mountain West, it's mitigated by travel costs for football alone. It would be absolutely astronomical. And Boise State is not going to give up great rivalries that they have in place and their position out in the western half of the country to go and play UCF and Connecticut. Well, not Connecticut anymore, but you know.
Well, and here's the issue. Because we live in a short-term memory and, society, people are looking at Central Florida for the past 2, 3, I'll even say 4 years, and banking on that versus looking at the whole run of the Mountain West prior to that. And I say, you're basing the AAC on Houston and UCF having, to their credit, really good, exceptional, great years, okay? So we'll say 5 years in total. But you look at the Mountain West and what they've done for 20 years and who they put up, the AAC can't touch that. So if you're looking for long-term stability, teams moving to the AAC, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And the fact that they said, well, if they take five teams and they make the big league, I said, we had that. It would just be WAC 2.0 when they had, you know, 18 teams and it was too far flung. I said, that's not going to attract people to wanting to do that. How you become better is being successful in your own league. And to your point, Boise State knows that. Boise State's already a brand. The AAC needs Boise State worse than Boise State needs the AAC. And I'd even say that for most of that league. The AAC needs probably a team or two from the Mountain West worse than one of those Mountain West teams needs to go there. That's just the reality. So when I hear that talk, I just sit there and say no. And even from CSU fans, well, we should go there. It's like, no, we shouldn't.
No.
But that's because of dissatisfaction with the Mountain West. A lot of people are unhappy with the Mountain West because of TV and those other things. But those are things that
that I think happen with any league. Pac-12 plays late at night. We're lamenting, well, we play late at night. Well, the Pac-12 plays late at night, and they're a Power 5 conference. That's why they have Pac-12 after midnight or whatever they call it.
Yeah, so, and I said this the other day, and I'll tell you this, that I said when you look at football and basketball and you look at the Mountain West lined up against the American Conference, I will take, without even questioning it, I will take the facilities in the Mountain West in football and basketball over the AAC any day of the year. Hands down, the athletic histories of these schools out here stack up more than enough with those schools. I mean, the most prominent school they had was UConn because of their basketball history. UCF, listen, I'm not taking away from what they did the last couple of years.
No.
But they had two great regular seasons. They came within a half in two different games against Memphis from everything falling apart. One, if Memphis holds on in the second half of the championship game, Fresno State is playing LSU in the Fiesta Bowl. As far as the question that I asked you, I will say this about Fresno State, if they can go back-to-back, and this is largely where one of the things I will probably say on Bulldog Insider, and I think that this season for Fresno State, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. I think the defense is going to be fine, even though they had some losses. The question for Fresno State is going to be on the offensive side of the ball, and that, for me, begins and ends with the starting quarterback this year, Jorge Reyna. Here's a guy who has got a cannon for an arm. He can make every throw. He's got terrific legs. He's not breakaway speed fast, but he's elusive. The couple things about Jorge that we're going to have to see is, number one, he likes contact. He's going to have to go out of bounds instead of getting the extra yard, because if he goes down, the season goes down. And number two, how is he going to lead right off the bat? His opening game, his first time starting, is going to be in his hometown of Los Angeles against USC in the Coliseum. And while USC isn't the team they were, they're still USC with four-star and five-star talent. I believe this team, even with the losses last year, can go into Los Angeles, and like they did, I don't think they'll pound USC like they did UCLA, but I think they can beat USC. I think a lot of the season and the direction of this season goes, even more than winning or losing, Marty, I think was how Jorge Reyna leads this offense in the Coliseum.
Well, I'm going to tell you the number one key for Fresno State, and I mean this sincerely. They got Jeff Tedford. And I'll leave it right there. He's a great coach. He's proven to win everywhere he's gone. And as long as he's leading that team with the way he runs an offense and leads, I'll take my chances. I'll take my chances with the Fresno State. I haven't even looked like at the Street and Smith or anything, but if Fresno State's favored to win the Mountain West again, it would not shock me or surprise me, and it's probably very worthy of being considered to do so.
Coming up, one more segment with Marty Lenz. We'll talk a little July 4th. What does Marty Lenz and family do on July 4th? Do they go to a baseball game? Do they go to a park? And like, his family's big enough to have a baseball game. We'll find out next. What do you do on July 4th? This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Well, I love the vamp of this song. A lot of you don't know, Marty's done some music radio, too. Done a lot of music radio.
Marty, I like that song, too.
Yeah,
that's
I do. I think it's cool. You know, I'm seeing up on the monitors the Mets-Yankees from Citi Field. This is neither here nor there, but so much is written and said about the new Yankee Stadium, and, oh, it's magnificent. I will tell you that Citi Field, pound for pound, is a better place than Yankee Stadium, because Yankee Stadium is like a giant, like a mall in Beverly Hills, and Citi Field at least has a little bit of character. But because it's the Yankees, they get all the pub, Marty. I mean, that's just...
Well, of course. Well, yeah, it's because of them. You know, the field could be decrepit or whatever, but it's gonna get the love because of who plays in the field. That goes to show you sometimes that atmospherics aren't as important as who inhabits them. You know, we've said this all the time. I know it's a good place, but I bet you Pauley Pavilion, a nice place, but I think a lot of times more of the lure of Pauley Pavilion is because UCLA plays there. Or even Cameron Indoor, Duke. I mean, there's better college basketball arenas that exist that are probably newer and more modern, but who, it's who inhabits them that makes it special.
I will say this, and there probably is no one who listens to me, knowing that I went to USC, that will understand this. Pauley Pavilion is a cool place, but it is by no means, because the sight lines behind the basket are not good. Even after renovating Pauley Pavilion, it's not good. It's by no means one of the better, more hostile arenas to go see college basketball in. You know, I'll take places, I don't know, like, well, Cameron is a perfect example. The Pit in New Mexico, your place, Moby Arena, is great. I like when it's filled up, the arena, Taco Bell Arena, whatever it is up in Boise, is a great place. And some of the older places like Williams Arena in Minneapolis for the Gophers and the old Wisconsin Fieldhouse, great place. All right, I got about 90 seconds here. What do you do on July 4th? What's your preference? If all things are in play, what's your preference?
Well, I'm probably going to do some yard work and drink some beer while I'm doing it. That's what I've been doing today and even kind of now. I don't really have plans. We're, you know, probably what we did last year may do the same thing. We live high enough up that we can take in fireworks from a lot of different vantage points. So we may do that. My mother's been calling me. I need to call her back. Guys, call your mother. Even at 51, I got to call my mother. So I may be hanging out with her. I don't really know. It's really up to the wife and the kids of what we're going to do. But we have no concrete plans.
You know, riding the mower and drinking is not a good combination. It's just
it's a push mower now. I gave up the riding mower years ago. Wish I still had it.
All right, because your lovely wife told me that when you have the push mower, you have that helmet with the two beer cans in it. You have the little funnel there. All right. Because I all the years I lived in New York, the night of the year that I didn't want to go out was July 4th. The fireworks celebration, I used to live in an apartment that had a rooftop, like a garden or whatever else, and it wasn't as nice as it said. It was gravel and, you know, a couple of, you know, garbage cans and grills up there, but you could see the New York Harbor fireworks, and that was pretty amazing. Otherwise, you took your life in your own hands for firecrackers and stuff being dropped out of buildings and what have you. One cherry bomb went off near me once. I couldn't hear out of my left ear for 2 days. So there you go. All right.
We have a dog, so we're thoughtful of the pets.
And good for you. You should be. Marty Lentz, folks, award-winning host, KOA News Radio in Denver. Marty, love to the family. Have a great and safe 4th, and we'll talk next week.
You too, my friend. Take care.
All right. Coming up, hour number 3. It's only a half an hour's worth, though. We'll do top 5 at 5, and don't be that guy leading into Giants Padres. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5. Before we get to July 4th tomorrow, hope you have some great plans set up. Make sure you're safe. Don't drink and drive. Enjoy yourselves. And a lot of you have the Friday off. We have Friday off here. Some of us do. And if you do, just kick back, relax, and enjoy. It's always an interesting holiday. In a lot of cities around the country, the big July 4th fireworks are actually tonight. Chicago is one of those cities because the suburbs have all of their fireworks shows on the 4th, traditional day. But the big downtown over the Lake Michigan, the lakefront right up next to Grant Park, they have that big celebration tonight. They got the Grant Park Symphony Orchestra, and it's pretty magnificent. About 2 million people find their way down, just parking on Lakeshore Drive and everything. And there's other cities around the country that do that as well. You heard Marty Lentz say that he's up high enough where they are in the mountains outside Denver to see a lot of different celebrations. One of the cool places in New York is if you are in Rye or Port Chester or some of the cities along Long Island Sound, as you look out from those cities all the way down on your left-hand side is the Connecticut and Rhode Island coastline. Mostly just Connecticut is what you can see. And on the right is Long Island. You can see every little town's fireworks dotting the sky at night. Pretty cool. And it's really not a lot different than when you see different suburbs here doing that. So enjoy yourselves on July 4th. Be safe. This is your pre-July 4th Top 5 at 5.
Number 1.
Well, go figure. Sales, and it really shouldn't surprise you, sales of the U.S. Women's National Team soccer jerseys have outpaced all other United States soccer jerseys. Everything from the MLS, everything from the USL, and that includes the men's national team. This is according to statistics from Nike and from Fanatics. Those are the two licensed sellers. Nike saying in their earnings report that the 2019 home jersey is the number one selling soccer jersey, men's or women's, ever sold by Nike. Fanatics saying that theirs, of the ones that they have sold over the years, top selling U.S. soccer national team jersey, men's or women's, of all time. That's just really pretty amazing when you think about it. And I mean the numbers are staggering, and you see, you know, Tony Landry and I joke about this all the time about how old you should be to wear a jersey, and this is something that him and I will never agree on, and I'm not saying anything that I haven't told him. I think you can wear a jersey at any age. He likes to say anybody above the age of 12, and you come on, you can't do it. You look at games, you look at people my age, Marty's age, Russ's age, you see grandparents, you want to wear a jersey, you wear a jersey. And when a team is doing particularly well, especially a team that is representing the United States, what's wrong with that? If you're feeling good, you're feeling a little patriotic, you're happy about the women's team, you're excited, you want to support them, you're going to a watch party, maybe you're going to a big public gathering somewhere. They've had watch parties all across the country. We've seen them out in Connecticut, seen them in Chicago, seen them in Kansas City. In Connecticut, I think it was in Hartford, but in Chicago, in Kansas City, and other cities, a lot of cities around the country. And you see boys, girls, men, women, I mean, you see people everywhere wearing jerseys. Nothing wrong with that, and not surprising at all. And you see what this women's program has done. Can you imagine if the men were good? Imagine if the men's national soccer team was good, the kind of sales that they would get. But I think the operative point here, or the main point here, is that a women's team that is loaded with tremendous athletes and personalities to match the athleticism has captured the imagination of the country, and I think that's a great thing.
Number two.
Well, the New York Yankees, they had hit a home run in 31 straight games. That's pretty remarkable. That streak has finally come to an end. They got beat by the Mets last night, 4-2. They're playing right now, actually, another series. It's another game at Citi Field. Mets trailing the Yankees right now, 2-1. Game is, I can't tell, it looks like it's the fourth. But Yankees lose 4-2, and they failed to homer for the first time in 32 games. Of course, that's a major league record. But the reason I mention this story is not to update you on the Yankees and the Mets, but one of the players on the Mets, this is an interesting comment that he had to say. And I want to make sure that I want to get the stats in front of me here. Just give me 2 seconds. I had this up a second ago, and then it just bounced off my screen. Okay, there we go. So J.D. Davis, he got a homer, and he also delivered the tying double, which helped the Mets rally. They were behind in the eighth, and they came back for the second consecutive game to win. They scored 5 times in their final at-bat on Sunday night, beat the Braves. So, pretty good. But J.D. Davis came out and said, "We are never out of the fight. We always come back, especially late in the game." And, of course, you're going to be feeling that way, right? I mean, you've had a couple of good comebacks, one against the Braves, one against the Yankees. I don't know if they always come back. Well, let's just be clear about the Mets. They're 39-47, 11 games back of the Braves. They have the third worst record in the National League. I mean, not trying to throw, you know, any water on their growing fire, but the fact of the matter is that they are out of a lot of fights, and they don't always come back. And it doesn't matter if it's beginning of the game, middle of the game, or the end of the game. Mets are 39-47, third worst record in the National League. So, nice thought, good win against the Yankees, but yeah, might be stretching it a little bit.
Number three.
Well, rough day for the Angels. Rough night last night in Arlington, Texas. Of course, Tyler Skaggs, his death weighing very heavy on the minds of everybody on the Angels, the entire organization, from players to front office to administrative personnel. And you saw and you read a lot of the comments. You heard a lot of the comments. People like Mike Trout, who came in to the same draft class with Tyler Skaggs in 2009, coming out saying, "I can't explain it. Lost a teammate, lost a friend, a brother. I've just got to get through it." You had team meeting at their hotel, which is 20 miles away from the ballpark. You had another team meeting in the clubhouse. And the Angels, a lot of folks were wondering why Major League Baseball told them they had to play the game. And then when you heard the comments from members of the team, they decided to play the game. The option was on the table for them to not play. Obviously, understanding that you're with your team, you're out of town, you the family environment of a team grows or it comes into play a little bit more prevalent because you're on the road and you just have each other. So what you heard coming out of the Angels was that they decided to play. They felt that, you know, I mean, you hear the line when something like this happens, that's what he would have wanted. I was particularly impressed, and it was really moving when you saw what the Texas Rangers did, being very mindful of the situation and just understanding that they're going to play the game and both teams are going to try to win the game, but it might not be the night to have the usual pomp and circumstance and what have you. And the public address announcer was his name, Chuck Morgan. He introduced the moment of silence, saying that the Rangers had offered their deepest sympathies and condolences to the family, to the entire Angels organization. It was really it was a very, very moving moment. And then you had the starting lineups of the Rangers being introduced by Morgan, and they kept them very subdued. And when the Rangers run to their positions, like so many home teams, if not most of them, if not all of them, there's some sort of theme song music that the team likes to have. Usually it's kind of a heavy, grinding metal song or something along those lines. Nothing. They didn't play any music. When the Rangers batters were introduced all night, every player has their own little walk-up music. That wasn't played. There weren't any between-inning things on the scoreboard. There weren't fireworks for Texas home runs. And it might not seem like much. It might only seem cosmetic. But I think things like that are important when another organization recognizes just the gravity of the situation. And that, you know, if you're a Texas Rangers employee and anybody involved with the organization, they fully understand that something like Tyler Skaggs, it's bigger than a game. It's bigger than the game, and they recognize that, and they went out of their way to do what was the right thing. And really, hats off to them for doing that. And, you know, it's going to take a while for the Angels to get back to business. And every time the Rangers go into a new town or a team comes in that they haven't played recently, you know it's going to come up every time. Guy gets a hit, goes to first base, someone's going to say something. Batting practice, when teams are switching out, somebody's going to say something. That's just going to go on for the next couple of months, if not the rest of the season. So it's tough, and that's why it was really, I thought, compelling to listen to what Chris Dufresne had to say yesterday when we talked. We talked about the NCAA versus California, but we started talking about the Tyler Skaggs situation and how life and death often intersect with work and sports in terms of our business. And he related the story about when he was on his way to cover the Sochi Winter Games in Russia for the Los Angeles Times. And while he was sitting on the fact that he had articles due for the Times, he was in the hospital that he was born in as he was essentially watching his mother die. And he told that story yesterday. It was very powerful. Very powerful. If you want to just hear something that's just really strong and compelling, you can hear it. It's on soundcloud.com/CG program. He's such a great writer, and he's one of those writers that just, he speaks like he writes, and he writes like he speaks.
Number four.
Well, Riley Opelka. You know the name Riley Opelka, Russ? Yeah, I didn't either. I don't follow tennis as much as I probably should. But Riley Opelka is an American. He is unseeded, and he took out three-time major champion Stan Wawrinka, 7-5, 3-6, 4-6, 6-4, 8-6 at Wimbledon a little bit earlier today to reach the third round of a Grand Slam tournament for the first time in his career. Now, he is ranked 63rd in the year. I'm sorry, 63rd in the world. Pardon me. And he's making his debut at Wimbledon. This is only his fourth Grand Slam tournament event. Of note, he is 6'11". 6'11". And, you know, I play tennis. I'm not very good. I'm better in tennis than I am in golf, but I'm not really any good in either. But one thing I know is that if you're 6'11", boy, you better have a great serve, and he does. He finished with 23 aces, and he had multiple serves that topped 140 miles an hour. One of them clocked at 142, fastest serve of the tournament so far. And he eight of his aces came in the final set to put the match away. But this is a guy, you wonder, like, where did he come from? He's only 21 years old. Where did he come from? When you're 6'11", boy, I tell you, if you've got the legs, if you've got the east-west quickness and the north-south quickness, if you've got the quickness to get to the net, to cover side to side, having a monster serve like he does, and you're basically, I mean, it's basically a slam, before the racket even strikes the ball. So, on the other side of it, for Stan Wawrinka, he's won three majors. The only major that he's not won is Wimbledon. And he's lost in either the first or second round of Wimbledon in the past 4 years. So, quite an upset by the 21-year-old. 21 years old, 63rd in the world, 6 feet 11. And he's finding his way into Wimbledon for the first time. And, wow, just you know, what a career might be ahead of this young man.
Number five.
Lionel Messi. If a U.S. professional athlete went into the tirade, the post-match tirade that he did, I'm just trying to imagine what the amount of fine and the amount of games being fined an athlete here would get. So he's captain of Argentina, and they lost 2-0, as they say, 2-0 to Brazil in Copa America in the semifinals, knocked Argentina out. Argentina's never won anything major with Lionel Messi. But Messi, the match was in Brazil, and Messi really didn't have anything to say about his own team. He had a lot to say about the officials. He said, and I'm quoting, "The officials were tired of making bleep bleep calls at this Copa, and they didn't go to VAR. It was unbelievable. It was like that all match. It was bleep," more like bleep bleep. Be very clear about that. "It was bleep bleep that they were doing it all match. There is no excuse. It must be looked into. Hopefully, CONMEBOL does," if I hope I'm saying that right, CONMEBOL, that's the governing body, "does something about these kinds of referees. Because we did everything to try and advance, but the officials stacked the deck against us." Wow. I don't believe they'll do anything, because Brazil controls everything. So it's very complicated. But I don't think we should feel bad for anything. Didn't happen, and we had bad luck. I'm upset because we had a great match, a great effort. It wasn't for it to finish in that way because they weren't the better team. So let's translate this, shall we? Just that one part where he says the comment about Brazil. Imagine Russell Westbrook saying, "You know what? We did everything against the Warriors to try and advance, but these NBA officials, they stacked the deck against us. They tried to help us lose. And the NBA won't do anything because the Golden State Warriors control everything. So it's very complicated." I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. So will he get fined? Will he get suspended? I don't know how he's going to get suspended. They're out of the tournament. I don't know what happens going forward, but imagine if an American professional athlete had those kinds of comments to say. My goodness. Yeah, Messi's not won a major title with Argentina. And, I mean, I don't know if his greatest days are over, but he said that, you know, the yellow cards, those were stacked against him. Everybody wanted Argentina to lose. And I wonder what Joel Lisman thinks about that. I should hold that thought and keep that question handy for him, because Messi isn't the first person to say this. He isn't the first soccer player to say this. Not only about referees, but about referees allegedly conspiring for Brazil to win. So, if you're a Brazil fan, sorry, but not the first time it's been said. Top 5 at 5.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll send you off to Giants baseball pregame show, Giants and Padres, getting it going. In case you haven't been noticing, of course, the Giants sitting in last place. I called them on Twitter the best 38-47 team in baseball. They're 19 games out of first, but as of last night, they were only 6.5 games behind the second wild card spot. And your San Diego Padres, at least for one person in our station, 42-43, 15 games under 500, and they're a little closer to the second wild card spot. Neither team doing very well, and a lot of people like to talk, like my Padres fan friend, I hope he's listening in the building, we'll talk about what garbage the Giants lineup is, and I would just remind him that the Giants are only four games worse than the Padres, for what it's worth. Well, you know, it's 5:26. It is a Wednesday, maybe a holiday week, but that doesn't prevent us from getting to this.
Don't be that guy.
Yeah, that's right. We don't want you to be that guy. Say it with me. You don't want to be that gal. You don't want to be a group of people who are doing something, or you see them doing something that you tell the person you're with, what is that guy doing? What is he doing? Every week we like to thank the state of Florida for providing so much material for us. Sometimes we go to their cousin, state of Alabama. Another cousin, state of Arkansas. We've gone up I-95. We've gone up I-95 to check out our friends in Maine. We've gone to New York City. Recently going to London. Today, for the first time, Tennessee weighs in. Happy to welcome Tennessee, Chattanooga, Tennessee, courtesy of the Associated Press. We always like to tell you that sometimes we tell you a story that is just absolutely too hard to believe. And just look it up. We don't make these things up, generally. No, we don't make them up. So we take you to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and introduce you to 21-year-old Caden Malia. Caden Malia, he thought it would be fun, to go to the Reflection Riding Arboretum and Nature Center. Chattanooga's Reflection Riding Arboretum and Nature Center. Thought it would be fun to go in there. It was closed, so he decided, well, I really want to get in there. Got a couple of things in mind. So he takes a rock and he breaks the glass. Breaks the glass to get into the nature center. And he comes across Evie the Bobcat. Evie the Bobcat is glassed in, as you would imagine. Evie's a bobcat. Evie's not going to be a good household pet, but he sees Evie and decides he not only wants to get closer to Evie, but he wants to play a game of fetch with her. Like, he tosses something, and Evie goes and grabs it and brings it back like his dog. So he gets into the bobcat cage, and him and Evie are having a catch. Well, not exactly. He tosses something to Evie. Evie just decides, I'm done with this. Nothing going on here. And Evie goes out. She leaves the cage right through the opening because of genius Caden Malia, you know, breaking the glass. And then she went out the front entrance through the glass that he broke to get in. Well, police eventually found Evie. She was a little skinnier. I guess she didn't have enough meals. Thankfully, she didn't eat somebody. She didn't eat Caden. Police, he was cited in lieu of an arrest on charges of criminal trespassing and vandalism. Why wouldn't they arrest him? Well, Caden, you know, you let Evie out. You let a bobcat out. Bobcat could have created some big-time damage, but, you know, we're not going to arrest you. We're just going to cite you for criminal trespassing and vandalism, and because there might be a second person involved, and we might think that person might be more involved than you. I mean, what are they thinking down there? He's supposed to turn himself in by July 14th. So that gives him a time to let a few more bobcats out. There one more piece of this story, and this might surprise you. Alcohol was involved. Alcohol was involved. So if you're keeping score at home, breaks the glass to get into the Arboretum Center, the Nature Center, breaks the glass to let Evie the Bobcat out, even though he wanted to go in and play fetch with Evie. Evie lets herself out of her cage. She lets herself out of the Nature Center. Police eventually find Evie. They track down Caden Malia and tell him, yeah, you know what? We're not going to bring you in. Not going to bring you in. Just going to give you a couple of charges here. We think there's another person. Maybe you want to give him or her up to us. And, oh, by the way, if you could just find your way back here in the next 11 or 12 days, that'd be great. We'd really be thankful for that. I'm not sure what they're thinking down in Chattanooga. I mean, how does the story change if Evie went out and Evie doesn't come back thinner? This is according to the police report, that she came back a little thinner. So it doesn't say how long it took them to find her. But what if she came back a little heftier? And there was, like, you know, somebody missing. I mean, I'm making light of it because it didn't happen. What are they doing in Chattanooga? For heaven's sakes. All right. My thanks to Tony D for hanging out. Nick Shager, a rare Wednesday appearance. Marty Lenz, my man Russ, doing his usual great job. All of you. Folks, Giants baseball coming on next against San Diego Padres, July 4th. Our nation's independence. Be safe. Have a wonderful Independence Day, a great Friday, great weekend, and we'll see you back on Monday. 2-hour show on Monday for the Home Run Derby. Until all of that, you're on your own.